This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 203 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm cold in Philadelphia. I'm going to ask for apologies in advance. I have a horrendous head cold this week. A head cold in July is not the best thing. But I'm David in Philly, and we've got a good show, so I don't have to talk. I brought in a guest this week.
That's right. We have a terrific guest. She's Liz Stalford. She's the test range manager for the Warm Springs FAA UAS test range in Oregon. She's a commercial pilot. She has multi-engine seaplane and instructor ratings. Liz has high-performance, complex, and tailwheel endorsements. She also has military unmanned aircraft experience, providing surrogate MQ-1 Predator and MQ-9 Reaper close air support to the United States Air Force's 548th and 549th Combat Training Squadrons during Green Flag pre-deployment exercises. Previously, Liz was General Manager and Chief Pilot for the Manned and Unmanned Flight Departments at AeroData. That aerospace and data services company specializes in persistent data collection, transmission, analytics, and distribution services. So, Liz, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Maybe we can start out and sort of lay the groundwork. Maybe you can give us an overview of what the Warm Springs UAS test range is.
Certainly. Well, it's one of three test ranges in Oregon, and it's under the Pan Pacific Unmanned Test Range Complex, which is known as PPUTRC, which is led by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And we have three ranges here, and then there are several ranges in other states as well.
So actually, you encompass quite a lot of geography, but that's kind of an advantage, isn't it, in terms of having different kinds of conditions available for testing unmanned aircraft?
Absolutely. Different clients need different kinds of environments to prove their UAS systems, and we're able to offer many, many different environments, from coastal to high desert in the mountains. And so various environments really do suit different clients.
Now, when we talk about the different clients, I think, as I understand it, you focus on certain target applications. Is that right? Things like transmission line and linear infrastructure inspection. That's one, natural resource conservation and wildland firefighting. Are those the kind of the three target applications?
Well, that is how we started out initially, and we've expanded quite a bit into every different area, including type certification projects, long-term test projects. So those are just some of the things that we're able to do as part of a reservation, because we have our own fire department. So we are able to light prescribed burns and have our clients fly them for the testing of different payloads. But we also offer many, many different options. And I've got a client that's coming in a few weeks that's looking at training. So they come out for a week, they bring the people that they would like to train on a UAS. So it's just various applications.
Do you guys have your own airfield for the test site, or are you using another? How are you set up as far as facilities go?
Well, it's, first of all, the Warm Springs Reservation is 1,000 square miles east of the Cascades, which gives our clients 300 days of sun a year to test in. and we've got different launch sites. One of them is very, very close to the lodge, the Kaneda Lodge. We're able to provide lodging, food, 5,400 square feet of brand new office space, and your test site environment, your launch site, all within the same small footprint. And that way your clients aren't having to travel, you know, back and forth between hotels and worry about food. We can provide box lunches down to the launch site as well. So we really try to make this as easy as possible and concentrate on service so that they can get the job that they need to get done swiftly.
Now, Liz, we have an international audience, and you've sort of suggested that there's a tribal connection here. Maybe you can explain what that's all about to our audience.
Right. So the Warm Springs Reservation is an Indian reservation, and it has a very, very large uninhabited landmass, which is wonderful for testing because you don't want to be in a congested area. But then you have the advantages of a beautiful resort with golf and swimming and upscale food and first-class service for various clients. And I think that that's very important and very unique. They're not shuttling back and forth between hotels and wasting valuable time. So that's a very big advantage. And then we have three mobile command centers, which can be trailered to any location and used for command and control handoffs. So that expands the distance that they're able to fly without using a chase plane.
And tell us a little bit about the projects that are underway, but also how do these come about? Do others approach you, or do you approach them? How do the projects materialize at the test range?
You know, it's really a combination of both. We've seen people coming to us. Now, when we had the development of Part 107 through the FAA, that allowed a lot of people to fly under 55 pounds up to 400 feet if they were certified and took the exam from the FAA. And that opened the door to many, many providers and didn't need a test site any longer for things like that. But we do have a blanket COA that allows us, that's a certificate of authorization, and that's allows us to fly anything under 55 pounds to 3,000 feet without going through the University of Alaska to have individual airframes approved. So it makes it very easy to fly up to 3,000 feet for something under 55 pounds. So that's one of the things that we can do easily. And then also to deal with much, much larger airframes that are, you know, upwards of 8,000 pounds. Hmm. And we can use the test range for testing those. Now, we did just bring in the Madras Airport and the Prineville Airport, because many clients these days want an asphalt runway. And they also want the amenities that an airport can provide, such as service for the aircraft and maintenance facilities, fuel, things like that. So I just expanded us into those two airports just in the last month. And that's a tremendous offering for clients.
Now, are those two airports under the same COA?
They are under the same COA, and it's just an extension of Warm Springs, even though it's not on the reservation. And the Prineville Airport in particular is very close to Bend, Oregon. And Bend, Oregon is a spot that many people come to visit. It's upscale living, and so we can attract the high-level executives because they actually want to be here rather than being in the middle of the desert and staying at a less than adequate $50 a night hotel.
Yes, I can imagine.
With limited resources. So we really wanted to bring in these other two airports so that any client with, no matter what their needs were, we could meet them.
It's an interesting concept that you're looking beyond just the testing, but you're also catering to the testers. If you're going to an environment like you are, like you're describing, and you're going to do multi-weeks or months worth of testing, you sort of want a level of comfort and some long-term stay where you, which is not something you would think about with being in a test environment.
Exactly. You want to be able to go hiking and fishing and be on the river like you can be in Bend. And you've got world-class fishing right there on the reservation. The Deschutes River runs all the way from you know, where we are down here in Bend, all the way through the reservation. So you really have a lot to offer clients no matter where they want to be. And that's very, very important. I think customer service is ideal, and they're not waiting in line to fly like they would be at a DOD testing facility in restricted airspace, which many clients think that they need to be in such a facility, and they don't. We can have them certified and flying just as easily as they can down there for much less cost and much nicer areas with more facilities.
Liz, can you tell us about some of the clients that have operations going on now?
We can't speak specifically to the clients. Many of them are under NDAs. They range from small UASs that are under 55 pounds, but that have endurances upwards of 20 hours. And then we've got clients that are looking at us for things that are like a max takeoff weight of over 8,000 pounds. So it really does vary quite a bit.
Now, obviously, we don't want you to disclose anything that you're not able to, but is the reason that there's this, I don't want to say veil of secrecy, but, you know, this desire to not communicate in detail what's going on there, is that because these clients are developing applications, commercial applications or other applications that they don't want their competition to learn about? Is that why the NDAs?
That's absolutely one of the reasons. And they would like to be able to test in private and have us respect that, and we certainly do. You know, we're looking at everything from high altitude to, you know, to missions, maybe perhaps for the government and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We have to respect their privacy, and they get the level of security that they would expect from a military test facility.
Now, speaking of military, you have both commercial and military experience. How important has that been to you and your job as test range manager?
I think it's been extremely valuable because I came from the Predator and Reaper sensor operations. And so many of the systems are similar. You know, you're dealing with payloads of various sizes and various capabilities. And that was absolutely the foundation for what I'm able to do, as well as being a commercial pilot and understanding airspace and deconfliction and things like that. So that's been critical. And the other thing that's important to know is that, for example, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft all located to Prineville for their data centers. And there's tremendous tax advantages in Oregon for a company to relocate. So that's what we're hoping will attract some of the aircraft companies.
Is the state of Oregon actively involved in the test site? We've seen in other cases where, for example, in New York, in upstate New York, where the region has recognized the economic benefit to the region of having a vibrant unmanned industry, I'll say, operating. Do you find the same thing in Oregon, or are you kind of doing it all on your own?
No, we absolutely have the support of EDCO, the Economic Development Office, the various city managers. They've been extremely supportive and doing whatever they can to assist us in the expansion process. So everybody recognizes that this has an impact for housing, food, and all the various things that people will bring to a community when they set up shop. And we can also set up manufacturing facilities. There's unlimited areas to set up hangars of whatever size the customer could possibly need. And I think that that's really important. That was one of the reasons for the expansion into the airports as well. We can also customize the hangars with office space, pilot lounges, restrooms, things like that.
What about international activity? Are the folks who are coming to the site here purely U.S. domestic, or do you see interest from outside of the U.S.?
We're absolutely seeing interest outside of the U.S. They're trying to decide, you know, who makes it easier to get us flying quickly. And we've been able to compete very, very successfully. So So they're looking at us. There's no question about it. We've had clients out here from Canada and Spain. And so that's a definite positive trend that we're seeing.
Yes, that's very interesting because, I mean, David, we've seen in the past where U.S. companies have gone outside of the U.S. to conduct their test operations.
Testing.
Yeah, because of the environment in the U.S. not being so conducive to that as opposed to what they find in other countries. So, yeah, it's interesting to see that maybe we're turning that around a little bit.
We're certainly doing everything we can to turn that around because there's no reason for a company to spend that kind of expense to go out of the country to test. But when they first began doing that, we didn't have the flexibility to get them in the air quick enough for the types of projects that they wanted to do, such as package delivery. But now we do. And so we need to get the word across that, we can support many different kinds of projects. And type certification is really where the bulk of the business is going to come from going forward. Type certification is going to be important. The FAA has laid out most of the standards for that, and we are seeing companies lean into that process already.
So you're talking about type certification for specific unmanned aircraft, right?
Right, 55 pounds and over.
Yeah.
Liz, talk a little bit about how you interact with the Anchorage site. Are you just operating under their COA? Do you feed information back to them? I know that when the test sites were originally set up, we were going to have a universal sort of FAA feed for everybody, sort of a network of all of the test sites. So how do you feed up to Anchorage and that way? What kind of interaction do you have there?
Well, it's actually not Anchorage. It's the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. And we have tremendous support from them. And we do. We report. We have a standard protocol that we go through to get somebody flying. So if you're 55 pounds and over, we go through a whole process to make sure all the documents are in order. We go through an independent safety review board meetings. And we have a step-by-step process that we go through. And they lead that effort. And then we report to the FAA in a portal that we have access to as test range managers. So they're very much a part of our testing process. And if the client needs more support, they will come down as well and help support the project.
Liz, tell us a little bit about your job as test range manager. What's your typical day like?
Well, it's a lot of business development right now. As we try to get clients to realize that we can offer above and beyond what they've received in any DOD testing facility. But when you're in the field and a client is testing, you've got test plan cards, you're ensuring that all the checklists are followed, ensuring that, the airspace is clear, and supporting the client in any way that they need support. So if they need extra pilots, then we can provide those for them. So it just depends on what we're doing on that day. But it ranges from business development to being right there in the field and working with them on the project.
Hmm. It sounds like you don't spend a lot of time sitting behind a desk wondering what you're going to do next.
Absolutely not. This job keeps us quite busy. This can be, and you have to be willing to work 7 days a week if that's what the client needs.
What's the size of the facility staff? Are there many people involved? Who is there besides yourself?
I have an extra range safety officer that I can call in when we need him. I've got a facility manager on staff full time, and he takes care of any of the logistics. So if a client needs more of a dirt runway graveled and bladed out in a certain area, he'll take care of that. Whatever it is that they need, we can accommodate them. So there's three of us that can work for a client full time, and then we have a number of other resources that we can draw from.
You really are providing a customizable solution. Are there challenges that you overcome? Or can you give us an example of maybe an unusual request by someone who was trying to test?
Oh, yeah. We had a very large company. It's a household name. And they wanted structures built, you know, raised antennas for this and platforms for that. And there's nothing that we won't do. I really believe in the motto of just make it so. Whatever the client needs, just make it so.
How Star Trek of you?
Yeah. Liz, because you have sort of maybe unique visibility into these projects that are taking place, can you give us a feel for how they're progressing in terms of when we might see these things go commercial or be implemented? I mean, are these projects that are years and years away from drawing to a conclusion, or things that are just a few months away from from being things that we can see and enjoy? What's the timeline kind of look like when you think about all the projects that are underway?
Well, as you know, anything under 55 pounds can fly at 400 feet or below. And there are a number of restrictions with Part 107. So we're already seeing them up being used for volumetric studies and wildlife conservation projects and various things like that. Now, in terms of the 55 pounds and over, those are considered aircraft. And we cannot fly those in the national airspace at this time. And that's why the test sites are so important, because they give the client the ability to get these aircraft up in the air and test them and work out all the bugs and modify the designs as they need to and lean into type certification projects, et cetera. But we are looking at, if I had to guess, and this is only a guess, I would say we're about 5 to 7 years from large UAS flying in the national airspace. And I would imagine that we're going to start with very rural areas at first, for pipeline patrol and transmission lines, things like that, and then move into some of the more populated areas. But it's going to be a slow progression, but we're not years and years and years away. We're probably looking at about 5 to 7, and that's only my best guess.
Yeah, sure. But it's an interesting data point, because I think it's something that many people wonder about. You know, how close are we to seeing large-scale deployment of some of these things? And, of course, a lot of things could change. It could accelerate, or there could be changes to the regulations that could move things either in or out. A lot of different things could happen, but it's an interesting data point nonetheless. What do you think, David?
Oh, I was going to ask her that infamous question that comes up in every job interview. So, where do you see your test site 5 years from now?
We see the test sites with a lot of type certification projects, because we believe that that's what the FAA is going to require, considering that there anything over 55 pounds is an aircraft that could do some damage if something went wrong. So type certification projects that take months and months and years to get through for a client. So that's where I see most of the work being done. And then in emergency services also, I see an increase in that. I think we're going to start to see unmanned water bombers that can carry the same amount of water as a single-engine tanker.
It's interesting. We'll put a link to the show notes, but ColumbiaBasin.com actually had a comment about Skyox, which is a unmanned water bomber, which I thought was kind of sexy because it looks sort of like a Catalina. But I thought it was a bit ironic that we've spent so much time talking about UAVs interfering with fire bombers, and here we have an unmanned fire bomber, UAS. So it's an interesting transition that we're going to.
It is very, very interesting. Yeah, the Flyox is an interesting platform. And right now, the Department of the Interior put out the first RFP for unmanned aircraft to do fire mapping and burned area response. And that's something that's happening now with commercial unmanned aircraft in the national airspace. And the way that they're able to accomplish this is they're in a TFR with an emergency COA. And that bid just closed a few weeks ago. And I actually did one of the first proof of concepts for the Department of the Interior over a real wildfire using a heavy, large UAS system. So I've been watching the progression of this since the very beginning.
And you actually said, so you actually started a wildfire for them to map it and put it out?
No, not exactly. This was an actual fire. We were on the Teepee Springs fire in Idaho. They called us out. They were looking at the proof of concept. They needed to see how we worked with air attack. And, you know, I come from manned aerial fire mapping. So this was an easy transition. And they used a real wildfire and brought us in. And yes, there's a lot of hesitation around, you know, can we stay out of the way? And I think the way that they're going to begin to use these is when the tankers come down, we put the unmanned aircraft up at night, and it provides the incident commanders in the morning for the morning brief with a much better set of intelligence to go attack the fire than they would have had otherwise.
Ah, I see.
Oh, that,
yeah.
Can you tell Max that I just got excited? That's that's brilliant. And I guess at night you can use an infrared sensor, and it would even give you a better view of the hot spots.
Oh, there's no question that infrared is just magnificent over a fire. Infrared is used just as much during the day as it is the night to pick up hot spots and be able to see the outline of the fire. So there's no question that IR is the main tool that's used.
And I would guess that previously you wouldn't have flights during the night, so you kind of lose those nighttime hours in terms of understanding what's going on the ground and being prepared to take the next steps.
Exactly. And then when it's time for the tankers to go up, they come down. And then that's a way to handle the deconfliction issue.
Sure. Yeah, brilliant. Well, Liz, really interesting conversation. Is there a website that our listeners could visit in order to learn more, or any other online resources that you might suggest?
Well, yes. Our website is WSUAS.org. That's for Warm Springs. And then also, you know, SUAS News, SUAS, is an excellent online resource to keep track of the industry and the changes. And SOAR Oregon is extremely important too. SOAR Oregon.com. They're very much an Oregon support system for, it's a 501c6, I believe, and they are an entity that was established to help increase the UAS activity here in Oregon.
Right. And that's SOAR Oregon?
That's SOAR. It's SOAR Oregon.com.
Great. Okay. Got it. Yeah, again, very interesting conversation, Liz. We want to thank you again for coming on the show, giving us a little peek into what's going on there in Oregon. It sounds like a lot of activity. It sounds like the level of activity is increasing. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely fair to say.
Yeah, wonderful. Great.
Yeah, we're very, very excited about it.
Very good. So, David, what do you think?
I like it. I kind of like the idea of going to Oregon and sleeping in a 5-star hotel and going and test my drone out on a flight line during the day. Sounds like a good life to me.
Yeah, and if you go if you visit in August, I think you'd be able to see the eclipse from that location. Isn't that right, Liz? Don't you guys have? Isn't the path of totality kind of sweeping through your area?
Absolutely. Bend is just a little bit off the beaten path, but only slightly. Madras, Warm Springs are just right there in the heart of it. So yes, it's going to be quite busy.
All right. If somebody actually was traveling through the area, there's no real door that they can knock on and say, hey, can I see the place, right? I mean, you don't have visitors. Is that a fair statement?
You know, we haven't. They would normally call me first and then ask me for a tour. If they wanted to be on the range with dirt runways and the lodge and all of the office space and mobile command centers, they're going to call me and say, let's go look at the Warm Springs facility. If they need the airport, I'm going to take them out either to Madras or Prineville.
I don't know. I still need an excuse to go to Oregon. I got to get that state blocked off on my map.
But one of the things that people think of when they think of east of the, you know, we're east of the Cascades, so we don't get the rain that Portland does. And when people think of Oregon, they think of Portland. And it does rain all the time west of the Cascades. But east of the Cascades here where we are, it's high desert. So it's beautiful sunny skies. And it may snow for a day, but then the sun is out the next day.
Great weather for flying. All right. Liz, again, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much. I'm a pleasure to be here.
All right. David, do we have a video of the week, do I see?
We do. Well, as I mentioned last week and the week before, I've sort of been living on Instagram for the last week or so. And today got posted a very interesting video by Lieutenant Juan Guerrera, Dr. Lieutenant Juan Guerrera. And he put a video using a 3DR Solo with a GPH-4B, shots of the Pensacola Beach during the middle of the Blue Angels midseason air show. He got permission. They were on a TFR. He got permission from the air boss to fly 400 feet down the beach. And it's a very quick video, but it is kind of amazing how many people are on the beach to watch the air show in Pensacola. We'll put the video on our webpage, since, or you can check it on Instagram. Juan's Instagram page is at Navy Blue Angel Doc. So that might give you a hint and tip on why he knows the air boss. Definitely watch the video and check out his Instagram page, because it's kind of entertaining to see behind the scenes what he gets to see every day. So
nice.
So that's that. And I guess with that, we should probably say, wrap this up. What do you think, Max?
Yes, this has been episode 203 of the UAV Digest. We want to thank you for listening. We especially want to thank our guest, Liz Stalford, for telling us a little bit about the activities at her test site. And as always, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. We've got show notes that you can go straight to by visiting theuavdigest.com/203.
And of course, we're all over social media. No, we don't have an Instagram page yet, but you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, at Facebook at UAV Digest. You can go visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/theuavdigest. You can visit our Cafe Press store. And of course, what we really love you to do is leave some feedback. Feedback at the UAV Digest. That sends it to Max and I. Go to Stitcher, Google Play, or iTunes and leave a review there. And of course, the last thing you can do is join our Slack listener team. We can send you an invite and you can have large in-depth conversations with our high-profile guests and listeners. And they have a good time, and it's a lot of really good learning experiences. So I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Philly, hoping I feel better by next week.
In Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.